Thanks very much, John. That was a very warm welcome. I barely recognised myself once you got into the Cephology. Yes, you're right, I did write that article about Australia as a Southern Hemisphere power, and I think I gave a presentation of it, maybe not here, I think maybe with Michael Wood at DFAT as well. So I wanted to take that idea and tonight and look at the other part of the equation in that article, which is the idea of soft power. And this is a concept that has been floating around for actually probably since the 90s. It was a Harvard professor, Joe Nye, is normally credited with introducing and popularizing this idea. And it's quite a simple idea. It's that if you want to achieve things in international affairs, there's the traditional hard power ways. You know, you can threaten military power. You can invade a country. You can use economic sanctions. You can, you know, you can purchase Greenland. They're all forms of hard power. But there's also another form of power, another very important form of power that Nye called soft power. And that's the power that a country has by virtue of its own attractiveness, its attractiveness in terms of its culture, its attractiveness in terms of its values, its attractiveness in terms of its government's policies. And that's this idea of soft power. And the key idea with using soft power is that it's all about persuasion and attraction rather than coercion. Okay? And that, you know, if you're a country that is seen as attractive and is seen as working well both domestically and internationally, you're more likely to get other countries to want to be part of what you're doing, to go along with you. And, you know, it's I think when Joe Nye framed it, he was really thinking about the United States. And the United States of the 1990s was a country with enormous soft power, still a country with a huge amount of soft power. It's got Hollywood, it's got Harvard, it's got everything in between. But it's probably got less soft power than it used to as a consequence of the Trump presidency. So soft power is a subject that is an idea that's gets tossed around. It's also found its way to into Australian foreign policy in recent years. This is the, I've got two dates there, that's very bad, 2018 and 2017. Well, let's go with the official, what it says on the cover of the report. So the 2017 foreign policy white paper, which probably some of the people in this room may have contributed to, which I think was actually a very prescient document in many ways, it's a very good piece of work. Not all white papers produced by Australian government bureaucracies are, you know, stand the test of time. But this one has actually been a very useful guide to the world that Australia finds itself in. And it too jumped on this idea of soft power in a way that we hadn't really seen previously. And, well, I've given the definition there, so I don't need to read it out to you. But in that second paragraph, you can see that DFAT not only talked about Australian soft power conceptually, but they also tried to make it real in terms of identifying the key aspects of Australia's soft power as they saw it, and putting those down in the foreign policy white paper. And so they listed democracy, multicultural society, a strong economy, an attractive lifestyle, and world-class institutions. Those were the elements of Australian soft power, according to DFAT. So what I wanted to do tonight was just take a little look at each of those elements of soft power and see if we can assess whether those claims stack up or not. And then if I have time, I have a sort of second, rather more academic-y part of this presentation. So we'll see how we're going for time. But if we have time, I'll then talk about how they we have tried to translate some of these ideas and operationalize them into actual policy. So, as John said, a sociologist is someone who studies elections and democracy. I have a long-standing interest in issues of democracy, so I was rather taken with this claim by our friends in DFAT that this was a core source of Australian soft power. Now, how would one assess whether that claim at an international level stacks up? One way is to take some of the comparative indices that are out there that attempt to rank countries in terms of their levels of democracy. And this is probably the best known one by an organization called Freedom House, based in the United States, in New York. And this is their map from, latest map from last year. And you've got three classifications in this big map. You've got free countries, democratic countries. They're in green. You've got unfree countries, autocracies, dictatorships. They're in purple. And then you've got the middle category. And actually, quite a lot of our immediate regions in that middle category in yellow. They're democratic, but maybe not fully democratic. Or they have free elections, but they've got problems with terms of minority rights. Or, you know, they have completely faultless elections like in Singapore, but they put all sorts of restrictions on the opposition. The way the United States is going, some states in the US might actually be in that last category as well. So, okay, so on this very crude but I think useful comparator, yes, we appear to be in good company with, and this will be important for if I get to the second half of my presentation, with Japan and India in our region, New Zealand, of course, Europe and the United States. And actually much of Latin America as well. So no great surprises there. Yeah, and this is really about the treatment of minorities and religious minorities in particular. So Indonesia was once, if we go back a few years, was the top-ranked democracy in Southeast Asia. And it has been on the rankings, it's been in decline. And it's really a lot about how particular religious minorities are being treated and some of the more illiberal aspects of politics that are creeping into. It's probably a bit hard to see, but the most democratic country in Southeast Asia and the only one that actually meets this group is this little dot there. So our friends in East Timor. So East Timor on every index now, not just this one, but all of them, is the top-ranked democracy in Southeast Asia, which is quite an achievement given where they were. All right, so I think we can agree that Australia is a democracy, and if we try and get into it and really break down some of the rankings, we can see that we are indeed in good company. This is a ranking of the civil rights and political liberty scores, so we're right up there with the Norwegians and the Finns and the Canadians, and we're ahead of the New Zealanders. So I think we can say, on a comparative international assessment, that claim stands up well. What was the second claim that DFAT made? Can anyone remember? Multicultural society. It's an interesting one. That's a source of soft power. America is well down this list. And credit to the Freedom House, because it's not easy, but America has been heading south on the list. That may all turn around in a year's time. All right, so multiculturalism. This is a long-term graph of Australia's overseas-born population starting back in the 1890s. And I just thought you'd find it interesting because it really shows something fundamental about Australia, which is we were an immigrant society and then we sort of were much less so. And huge drop in the years leading up to the Second World War, and then, of course, this huge increase after the Second World War when Australian society was completely transformed. So we had a big overseas-based population before the war, but most of them were coming from one place, you know, UK, Ireland, Then after the war, of course, they were coming from lots of places, Southern Europe to start with, increasingly Asia today. We now have almost 30% of our population born overseas. That's the highest level in the OECD. It's higher than the United States, Canada, you name a country. It's an exceptionally high level on any comparative indicator. And again, in terms of the thinking about the Indo-Pacific, where are our overseas-born population coming from? They're increasingly coming from this part of the world. This is stats from, I think, 2015, but it had a nice graph, so I thought I'd show it to you. But the growth, very much India, China, Philippines, Pakistan, Vietnam, Nepal, Malaysia, all these countries, as well as some of the traditional source countries, such as the UK and Ireland. So, again, I think pretty clear that on a comparative indicator, in terms of multicultural society and in terms of comparisons with other countries, this is indeed a bit of a standout for Australia. As anyone who works in the education sector knows, this is also Australian higher education is increasingly underpinning this migration process. So, and actually education is probably the classic soft power indicator in some ways. You know, do you dream of your kids going to study in, you know, people dream of their kids going to study in, you know, Yale or somewhere? Okay, that's a power of attraction very directly. Obviously now there are at least some people in developing countries in particular who dream of studying in Australia because after mining, this is now our largest export industry. And we have created a really different kind of migration situation in Australia by virtue of our extremely high levels of international students. So we are fourth in the world and not, you know, that far behind the numbers of international students taken in much bigger countries. And again, they're coming from the Indo-Pacific region. So we will, if this trajectory keeps up, we will soon have 1 million international student enrolments if you combine higher ed, ELICOS, vocational education, school education, and others. So this is, in a country of 25 million, this is absolutely enormous. And this is something that's happened very quickly in Australia, maybe in, you know, certainly less than a decade. And any of us who work in universities are now part of a massive export industry as well as, you know, an industry that's about educating people. And again, where are they coming from? They're coming from the Indo-Pacific region. Unfortunately for Western Australia, they're not coming here in anywhere near the same numbers. Well, you could say fortunately, unfortunately. I mean, there's really, you know, there's mixed benefits of having huge numbers of international students. I think people are well aware of the debate about Chinese students, you know, and how dependent so many universities are. But if you look at this graph, I just wanted to put it up there, you see how low the numbers in Western Australia in particular are compared to the big East Coast states of New South Wales and Victoria. I mean, you know, 1/10 of the number of Chinese students, less than 1/10 compared to New South Wales, you know, which is only, you know, a bit over twice as big as Western Australia, similar proportion for Victoria. In most categories, I think when I looked at it, the only category where Western Australia seems to outperform in terms of international students was students from Malaysia. And the other thing I would point out there is how small the number of Indonesian students are, which is, you know, a source of ongoing puzzlement and concern, given, you know, we're right there. It should be very easy. I would say this element of Australian soft power and the link between this element of Australian soft power and the Indo-Pacific is pretty clear. What was the next one? Strong economy. This is where things get a bit tricky. And one of the reasons I wanted to put all that information about migration and student numbers up was to talk a little bit about this graph, because this graph's a problem for us. Australia now has so many, we have had such large immigration rates since the Howard years, and we have so many international students and people on 457 other short-term visas, that it is now affecting the nature of the relationship between people's individual wealth and the country's wealth as a whole. So since forever, our GDP per capita was a lot bigger than our total real GDP. But those basically have crossed over now. So we are now, even though our economy is still growing, and you know everyone talks about us having, you know, how many years is it? 26 years of economic growth. We're still growing, just, but increasingly we're growing because we're bringing in people. And the main source of our growth is migration. And this changes the equation. So the pie is still getting bigger, but it's not getting bigger as much, and more people are coming in. So in one sense, GDP per capita is now starting to fall. We are in a recession, a per capita recession. And we've been in per capita recessions before, but this is a bit of a worry, because what it suggests is that the rate at which the overall pie, the overall economy is growing, is not through productivity improvements and new products and so on, is not in sync with our immigration rates. And what has happened is that we are keeping the economy bubbling through bringing more people to buy houses. And, you know, hence the little quote there. I don't know if you can all read it, but this was a rather inflammatory article that came out in a very well-respected international affairs journal, Foreign Affairs, not long ago, which claimed that Australia has become an immigration economy and that the world's first immigration economy, according to this author, and that as a result, Australia's heavy reliance on immigration to float the economy and fund government budgets runs the risk of turning into a giant Ponzi scheme. So I think that's a perspective that, given that we've been talking about immigration, multiculturalism, and strong economy, that we really need to keep in mind. If the nature of our economy is now based on immigration, then we have to keep it going. We have to keep bringing more and more people in. Otherwise, there's nothing to keep the economy running. I'm not an economist, but certainly I have heard other people making similar claims, and it's an interesting article. So I suggest you check it out. What does it mean for our soft power? Well, the idea of soft power is that you're attractive, you know, by virtue of your culture, your values, your strong economy. But if your strong economy is actually because people are coming here and that's only the thing that keeps your economy strong, then it's a little bit of a tough call. So I would say for DFAT, not so sure that we can claim that as a source of soft power. What was the next one? Can anyone remember? Attractive lifestyle. We've got an attractive lifestyle. Come on, we've got an attractive lifestyle. Do we need to discuss this? We have a nice lifestyle. We're very lucky, particularly here in Western Australia. We have a really nice lifestyle. Whether we are a lifestyle superpower, it's a case to be made. So yes, I think we'll give that a tick. And the final one was world-class institutions. Well, I don't know. Maybe DFAT's talking about the bureaucracy. Maybe it's talking about Parliament. Yeah, I mean, universities. We call ourselves world-class. Every university talks about, if you don't see the word world class somewhere in a university brochure, you know, someone's had a bad day. So, again, you know, maybe we've got world-class institutions. Yes, Tim? Well, we have people from DFAT here in the audience, so we could ask. I think some of these, I think they probably had in mind our rule of law and the strength of our formal institutions, which I think, you know, you can make a very strong case for. We're a very stable country politically. But they didn't say, so I don't know. Well, it's partly values and it's partly real, you know, the real respect for the rule of law, the written constitution and so on. I mean, given, you know, I mean, it'd be interesting in comparison, say, to what's just happened in the United Kingdom, which is going through a constitutional crisis. I mean, we've been through constitutional crises in this country, but the rule of law and the institutional structures set up at Federation have always prevailed, even when, you know, the Governor General kicked out the Prime Minister. So, I think it's certainly you can make a case, but it's just not clear how you would measure that. So, look, that's the good news. That's the good news, but it's not all good news. So, a couple of areas where we might be losing our soft power. First of all, we seem to be becoming more corrupt. And again, this relates to institutions and values. Just yeah. So, and again, there's lots of comparative data on this. The most widely used one would be Transparency International, which does a sort of perception of corruption. So you don't ask, are you corrupt? Because you're not going to get a very useful answers to that. And you can't even ask, have you been involved in a corrupt transaction from someone else? Has someone tried to bribe you? Because again, so you just say, look, what's your perception? Is there a lot of corruption in this country or not so much? Or, you know, and if you're in Indonesia, you're saying, yeah, there's quite a bit of corruption here. In Australia, we've always done very well, and it's always been actually a bit of an anomaly given that how much, you know, we are so connected with countries that do rank very highly on the corruption index. Quite a few of them in Asia, and yet we don't. But just in the last few years, we've started to decline. And there's been studies from my old colleagues at ANU and other places that have come up with similar findings. And again, this is a perception, but it's quite widespread that corruption in the media, political party unions, parties all seen as being increasingly corrupt. Now, if you're making a claim, a soft power claim about, you know, the strength of your values and democracy and so on, that's a bit troubling. That's all right. No, you can get it if you want. But I think there's actually some more direct indicators of soft power erosion. And here are just a couple. One is that, you know, we had this, we were back in the 70s and 80s, not at Scandinavian levels with our aid, but we were, as percentage of GDP, we were close to the 0.5, which I think was the UN sort of minimum threshold that they suggest. And we had another blip here around the Rudd years when all that tax revenue from the mining boom came in and they just didn't know what to do with it all. So a lot of it ended up being given out as aid. And that then very sharply decreased under the current government, or the Conservative government that we've had under different prime ministers for a couple of years. And we are now down to almost 0.2, which is really low, really low. So we've gone from being the sort of Scandinavians of the South Pacific to, you know, very miserly in comparative terms on foreign aid. Two other areas where we are increasingly seen as free riders in amongst sort of fellow countries with similar viewpoints. One is our offshore refugee regime, which the UN believes breaches international law, excising bits of the country from our own territory in the Migration Act. We're actually very generous to refugees when they get here. There's a lot of welfare and so on, but not many get here proportionately. Now, there's 60 million people looking for a home in the world, so we certainly can't take all of them like the Greens would like us to. But, on comparative terms, we're seen as probably not pulling our weight and probably being a free rider. But, of course, the real area we're seen as being a free rider is in the global climate change action or lack of action. This is becoming, I think this is becoming going to become a problem for Australia. It was a problem for Scott Morrison when he went to the Pacific just a month ago and ended up dominating talks that he wanted to talk about other things. For those of you who've been following the news in the last couple of days, are increasingly being called out internationally at the UN and other places because of the government's policies, or really lack of policies on climate. So I think those are three areas where our soft power really has eroded, and it's probably a bit unfortunate for DFAT just at the time that they've embraced this idea and really invested in it, on some pretty big issues, Australia has pretty clearly lost soft power. The other big problem we have is that we are a huge exporter of CO2, so it's not just about what we're doing domestically, it's what we are exporting internationally. And largest coal exporter, almost the world's largest gas exporter. So you can see the sort of countries that we are with now: Russia, Saudi Arabia, the Americans, who are pretty much energy independent now, and a bunch of others. So maybe not the company that we would have seen ourselves in, in previous years, but we are in now, I think, a vulnerable position, because unlike the Americans or any of those European countries here, we could quite easily get hit with, say, trade sanctions from the European Union if they ever wanted to. Green parties are now becoming mainstream in the EU. So I think if I would have to pinpoint an area of risk or vulnerability for Australia, that's probably it. We are actually, I think, negotiating a free trade agreement with the EU at present, and I think you can guarantee that environmental issues and the climate issue in particular will be part of that. So it'll be interesting to see how our government handles it all. So where does that leave us? We're a democracy with a nice lifestyle. That's it. That's our soft power. We're a democracy, we're a nice lifestyle. Those are unambiguous. All right, so I said I had a second, slightly more academic-y part of the paper, which I'm happy to move on to now. Yeah. And what I want to do now, and I realise I'm talking lots of information here, so I'll try and get through it pretty quickly, but the second part of this paper really tries to say, okay, if this is our soft power, what are we going to do with it? How do we make it real? How do we operationalize it? How do we turn it into something? How do we turn it into policy? And if you look at the evolution of Australian policy and Australian thinking about soft power and things like values and democracy, it's really quite interesting what's occurred. There's been a big shift in a relatively short space of time, 5 or 6 years, from not talking about these issues at all towards embracing them. And I think that discussion of values, democracy, values, rules-based orders, and the construction of the Indo-Pacific as a region has gone hand in hand. So I'll try not to get too much into the boring academic side of this, but I'll just trot through some of this. So The argument here is that when we think about the Indo-Pacific region in Australian foreign policy, we are also bringing along this idea of values and democracy as a very central part of it. And I think you can make, I can make that argument because these are things you can actually measure and track. Again, if you're a nerdy academic like me, you can go back and look at what is being talked about in some of these white papers that the bureaucracy puts out. And we've got a bunch. We've got the defence white papers, we've got the foreign affairs white paper, we've also got the Asian Century white paper. I don't know if anyone remembers the Asian Century white paper. It was a big initiative of the Gillard years. And if you go back to that paper, there's not a lot of stuff about values or the Indo-Pacific. Since then, a lot. So I think there's been a bit of a twin Indo-Pacific values have sort of really come along. Now, Indo-Pacific. Why are we talking about the Indo-Pacific? I always like putting up this slide. That's why we're talking about the Indo-Pacific, or that's at least one reason. Most people in Australia know this. When you put this slide up in Europe or America, people just gasp and fall off their chair and they just can't believe it. They cannot believe it's true. But actually, that circle is too big now. This was done by, I should credit, this isn't me, this is someone, I can't forget, sorry, whoever you are. It's out there on the internet, so I took it. Someone became quite well known for creating this a few years ago, but it turns out that this circle has shrunk. So you don't even need most of Japan anymore to be in it, and you've still got more people living inside this circle than outside of it. So that's one reason. Another reason is this. That's shipping and oil shipments, energy. So we're talking about the Indo-Pacific for a lot of reasons, but one reason is because that's where everyone is. Second reason is because the lifeblood of energy for Asia still increasingly comes from the Middle East, still comes across the Indian Ocean, and to that extent, of course, we too are dependent on energy supplies from the Middle East through the Indian Ocean, and the stability of that region is super important to us. I happen to think this whole concept's been fantastic for Perth and Western Australia. It's become a central part of UWA's branding and focus because it puts us actually at the centre of things. We've never been at the centre of anything, ever. We are at the centre of this concept. So for Australia, this is a no-brainer. Whether it has staying power, we will see. One thing that hasn't happened with the Indo-Pacific idea yet, it hasn't been institutionalised in any way. Here are all the bits of regional architecture that Australia has some connection to, the East Asia Summit, RCEP, APEC, the old TPP, da, da, da. So there's no Indo-Pacific grouping, and there's probably not room for an Indo-Pacific grouping, to be honest, but at some point we probably need to, if the concept is going to last, it will probably need to be institutionalised. Okay, so I told you I was going to look at the white papers, and I'm conscious I'm running out of time, so let me do this really quickly. So, Asian Century and Defence white papers didn't talk about values, didn't talk about the Defence white paper 2013 did mention the Indo-Pacific, but very much Pollyanna-ish. Everything was going to be great. We're going to sell lots of stuff in Asia. They were going to buy all our stuff. We're all going to get rich and prosperous. It was all going to be so great. China was going to just become this, fantastic, valued member of the international community. It was going to be a responsible stakeholder, and it would be a democracy. It was just on this. So all of that, remember all that? That's what everyone, at least, I don't know if anyone actually believed it, but they said it. None of those things proved to be true. And as we've faced an increasingly disruptive China that is increasingly authoritarian at home and aggressive abroad, all of a sudden this idea of a rules-based order and democracy has become very important to Australia for obvious reasons. And it went from nowhere to being mentioned, 48 times, the rules-based order. And then, of course, I've mentioned the foreign policy white paper, which is really talking about values enormously. So 31 references. See this? This is what you can do these days. 31 references to values, lots of things about liberal democracy. We're an advocate of liberal institutions. We support them internationally. Great. Okay. So I could talk about the Quad, but I'm running out of time, and I could talk about that. But I'm just going to talk about this. I'm just going to talk about this. This is what Anwar Ibrahim said when he was released from jail last year. He said, well, you say you're supporting liberal democracy. You say this is one of your core values. It's there in your policy documents. We hear, you know, but you don't do anything. I've been locked up for 10 years. No one came. No one said a word. Everyone just, you know, went quiet. And if you are seen to be appeasing ruthless, corrupt, authoritarian leaders, you know, you get called out. So we got called out by Anwar Ibrahim. Now, of course, it's extremely difficult if you want to integrate with Asia and be part of the club to be talking about democracy in Malaysia or in Vietnam or in China or in Singapore or any of these places. But if we say we're going to do it in our policy documents, then this has set ourselves up for exactly this kind of criticism. So I will stop there. I know this has gone on for quite a while, but I'd be very happy to have a discussion and questions. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Ben. That was terrific. Just in terms of soft power and democracy, I'm reminded of my wife, Jenny, those of you know, was a diplomat, and she had to show a Thai senator through the House of Reps, and he was there for question time to see the delights of Australian democracy on show, and he was visibly shaken by the experience. Can be fairly rough. But look, we've got time for questions, so microphone over there, if you could, as a courtesy to our speaker and everyone else, just identify oneself and keep the questions fairly punchy. Flavia, come on up. You can start.
Thank you, Ben, for another very interesting presentation. I'm Flavia Bellini Zimmerman from AIAWA. When you're talking about soft power and soft power thinking and the erosion of soft power, Australian soft power, I was just thinking, what could be done to perhaps work a little bit more on those issues that you're raising, that in the past, Australia, I don't know, like aid and Australia's standing on climate change. So how can we perhaps try to rewind a little bit, and whether there is any political climate for it to happen so that we can still capitalize on those concepts? Thank you.
Well, thank you. I think, you know, analytically, think of soft power as a combination of culture, which I think we've agreed we have a, you know, reasonably attractive, at least in terms of lifestyle and so on, values, but also policy. And so I would think in Australia's case, the first two are fairly, you know, they don't change quickly anywhere, and they haven't changed much in Australia. But in policy terms, you know, we have, and we've elected, you know, these are democratically elected governments, let's be clear, that have made some quite drastic changes. So in one sense, you know, how to turn that around is obvious. But I think a bigger issue is whether there is an appetite for Australia to play this kind of role. You know, some of these discussions about soft power were coming at a different time when maybe the trade-offs involved in acting on climate change, for example, weren't as apparent as they've become. So I don't think it's an easy thing. I'm not sure there's great enthusiasm for Australia becoming a major aid donor again. I think it's much more about targeted aid. So we may just have to resign ourselves to the fact that we've gone from being one of these countries that everyone liked to a country that's not liked that much. Yeah, which will be a difficult transition for people in the international arena.
A question there from Savannah. Hi, thank you, Ben. A wonderful presentation. I was just wondering, you talked about the Indo-Pacific idea and as an example of Australia's soft power. I'm just wondering if we superimpose on that the idea of the Quad, you know, Japan, Australia, India, and the US, won't that in itself erode our super soft power status? Because effectively what it would come down to is that we talk about a large area connecting people, but in reality we have a local concept of Europe, concept of Indo-Pacific. And in that sense, anyone will be both judged at the criteria that we identify for ourselves and then also criticized for not following it. So I was really interested in the fact that we have India as a democracy. There's huge problems and the similar problems as in Indonesia, but we're assuming that it is. But once we Quad becomes significant, then that judgment would become stronger. So I don't know what you want to say.
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. And this is, you know, this is something that we could have a whole seminar on this issue, because I think there are really different ways of saying this. On the one hand, as someone who is interested in democracy and values, you know, I like the Quad. I mean, I've always supported it, because I think this is a tangible way of saying, okay, we believe in these things, we will get together with other significant countries who believe in the same thing. But on the other hand, and it's not just us who faces this problem, the Japanese are facing this problem in a big way. You know, if you talk, I mean, Abe's talked up this idea of a free and open Indo-Pacific more than we have, but then they don't want to actually do anything. And they get a lot of pushback, particularly from ASEAN. Let's leave China out of it. Just from ASEAN, ASEAN don't like this idea. They think it will divide ASEAN between the democracies and the non-democracies. They don't want it. So it's one of these classic collisions between, you know, an idea and a reality. Having said that, who was it? Mattis, I think, at the Shangri-La Dialogue just last year, talked about the Quad and said this is all about four democracies and the fact that we are democracies together and we share values, we see the world the same way, and, you know, when the Americans get on board with an idea, we often get on board with them. So, yeah, we'll see.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much, Ben. I'm a big believer in the implications of soft power, and I think that a country that has soft power is typically doing better than a country which tries to rely upon hard power. But I do wonder, and it struck me in the course of your talk, that we're often conflating two very different things when we talk about soft power, talking about our attractiveness, which is often measured in terms of who wants to come and study here and who wants to actually hop on a boat and come here, and our influence, our ideas, and it seems to me they're not correlated. And we might be talking about just two completely different things. I mean, for instance, Australia, I think, had more soft power in terms of its influence with ideas back in the 80s and 90s when APEC was created out of, you know, an Australian idea, than is the case now. And you identified some very negative influences on our soft power when you talked about climate change and the like. And there are countries like the Scandinavians, you know, Sweden, which are immensely influential in terms of ideas, I think, but, you know, who wants to necessarily go and live there through a winter? So apart from yourself, so I just wonder if we're talking about two different things here.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, Mike, and I actually agree. I think that is a very succinct way of framing the problem. But I'd throw it back at you. This is the DFAT formulation. And inherent in that, I mean, I quoted one bit, but I mean, there's a whole chapter in the white paper that doesn't see this as being problematic, that essentially conflates the two. And I think you're right. I mean, I think partly because, you know, we've imported this idea from the Americans. You know, in the US, people want to move to the US, but it also produces all sorts of things, including lots of big ideas. People want to move to Australia, it's not clear that we produce that much of things, all big ideas at present. So I, if we're honest with ourselves, so I think, you know, we're a nice place, you know, nice place to live, pleasant place to live. So in a sense, I would say, you know, the reason I call this soft thinking was precisely because I think there is a bit of soft thinking in this use of soft power within things like the foreign policy white paper.
So your talk is obviously about Australian soft power, but one of the flaws of soft power theory is it kind of constructs the nation state as a monolithic category. So the most kind of influential soft power categories in recent times has been the Global Livable City Index. So how does Perth, can we kind of dissect Australia more at a regional city urban level in terms of Melbourne being the most, you know, livable city? What is Perth missing out in terms of how you constructed the education sector, livability? So is this something about Perth that could be said that's interesting, yeah, compared to the East Coast?
Yeah. Well, good point, Tim. And that would have been a good index for me to put up, because you're right. That's a really important indicator. And Australia has done very well. Melbourne, in particular, Sydney pops up there sometimes. Perth doesn't really get much of a look in. I think. You'd have to go and look at the methodology, because I personally think Perth's a much nicer place to live in than Sydney or Melbourne. But, we probably don't have as much going on. Some of the things that we might really value, I mean, I put up a picture of a beach, might not be the things that are valued so much. But look, if we step back from that sort of like nuancing, Australia does very well on these sorts of, yeah, nice place to live, best cities, best place to be an expatriate, indexes. But I think that comes back to the point that Mike raised, which, you know, that's different from being influential in the international arena. You know, if all you've got is that you're a nice place to be, then a lot of people want to be there.
But that's the education sector, right? That's part.
Well, I would say that the education sector and the migration sector are now so intertwined.
Right. Yeah.
It's increasingly, if we did not have a migration pathway from education, we would have a completely different international student situation. Yes. That's what's happened. It's turned into this monster industry.
So we've got time for three or four quick questions. There's one there, lady here, and one down here. That's it.
Thanks, Ben. That was a really interesting talk. The striking thing is very much that came across to me is how much this idea of soft power is based on the existence of these things in Australia. And yet when you look at other countries around the world, it's much more about the projection of soft power. And that seems to be the missing part, and it's certainly the missing part in the foreign policy white paper. Given your slide on the erosion, the decreasing aid budget, the isolation from major arguments like climate change and so forth, that it's very difficult to project soft power when Australia's presence is decreasing, its aid budget is decreasing. Are there any alternatives? I was going to ask offer one. To what extent does Australia... can it be successful in projecting values through other international organisations, through the multilateral system, through its influence on the multilateral system, either through the UN, the World Bank, or the other regional banks, as a way of compensating for its lack of bilateral presence?
Well, it's a good question again, and I'd have to think about it, but my initial reaction would be that just as the Scandinavians do so well and are so influential within these international multilateral organisations, not because they're big, they're small countries, you know, Norway's got 5 or 6 million people, but because of their policies and their approach, we would probably need to change our policies and approach to have that sort of influence. I actually think Australia is probably heading into a lonelier future, not necessarily a worse future. There's plenty of countries that are not, you know, are not well regarded and not part of big international clubs and do just fine. You know, maybe we're big enough now to be that country. But it's a real departure. It'll be a big shock for a lot of people who work in the international game for Australia.
Oh, there's a question there, and then lady here, and down here, and that's all we've got time for.
Ben Robert Whitehead, I'm a member of the Institute. Thank you very much for your very wide-reaching address. I want to ask you about the Indonesian lack of us being a draw card for them on the education scene. But, and just before you respond to that question, a bit of irony here in the fact that we're such a wonderful place to live, and yet we have the highest rate of antidepressant medications on the planet. So just a comment about that. Thank you. But really, Indonesia is a serious question.
Well, they're probably some of the people who are taking the antidepressants are the international student officers who are tasked with getting the Indonesians here, because no one can work it out. You know, we're 3 or 4 hours flight away, lovely environment. We've got on any objective indicator, a much better education system than Indonesia, and it's comparatively affordable compared to going to the US or so on. But nonetheless, we have not yet been able to turn that into a big industry. And look, I don't know the answer. It's probably the Indonesian elite, I don't think, necessarily want to send their kids to Australia. And the elite are the only ones who can afford it. So, you know, they've got the whole world to choose from.
Later here in the flight jacket.
So the slide you showed on the economy was quite startling, and the accusation of becoming a Ponzi scheme is also is not a good one. But with the likes of Donald Trump and Fraser Anning and their sorts of comments and the divisions we're seeing, do you think it's possible that we could have a rational debate on sustainable migration?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that the Donald Trumps and the Fraser Annings are the key problem here. I think the fact is neither of the big political parties, you know, want to have that debate, because it opens up the racism problem, and it opens up a whole bunch of other things. Essentially, the way conservative governments in Australia, under Howard in particular, and also more recently, have played the immigration card is to be really tough on a small group of people who the media, you know, will show, people who come on boats, and to be extremely not tough on people who are coming on a plane, to the point where we now have, I think, 60,000 appeals cases for refugee claimants. You know, so essentially, land, get your student visa, come here, get to the airport, make a refugee appeal, make a claim for refugee status, and then appeal it, which gives you 2 years to work. Then you work. That's the model, and that is now a big part of our economy. And the other thing that it's doing, I hate to be the sort of voice of doom here, but this is a really important issue. It's taking away a lot of the low-paid jobs that young people that I used to do when I was your age, you know, because there's this new very large group of people who will work, you know, for very little and aren't always covered by awards and so on. So I think it is a debate that we have to have. But you're right, the sort of the racism issues and others make it difficult. And there's this macro issue that both parties are now, so we're so deep into it, to stop it, if we did it, there'd be a recession. So that's the problem we're now on. We're on this sort of, you know, the horse is riding, and we just got to keep riding it until something happens.
And last question from Anna.
Okay. I can just speak up. Thank you so much for your presentation. It's really interesting. I was just interested more in the concept of soft power as such, and how, you know, we talk about values of democracy, multiculturalism, etc. But I wonder that whether in light of recent changes, global developments, you know, a Trump administration and other world leaders that are not resorting to the classical concept of soft power and abusing that, has the concept of soft power changed in and of itself, or is it changing? And, you know, is it still, you know, as relevant, whether or not Australia holds these?
No, I think it is relevant, and in some ways I think it's probably more relevant. But you're right, it's not now, the United States, for example, wouldn't be the place that we'd look to, but countries that either have incredibly appealing, strong cultures but also project them, like the French or the Japanese, these sorts of countries do very well. The UK, until very recently, would often top a lot of these soft power things. So there's opportunities now because there's all these self-inflicted wounds from the traditional, you know, the soft power country. So no, I don't think the concept's going to go away. In fact, I think in some ways it's going to become more important.
Look, on that note, there were plenty more questions. I apologise if I didn't get to them. Thanks very much, Ben. So I wonder if I could ask my colleague, Amy, one of our vice presidents, to move to a formal vote of thanks.
Well, I'm going to stand over here, Ben, because I don't know if you've seen our banner, but we are very much front and centre in our banner here, and I guess that's what we are all about here at AIIA Western Australia, just that, I guess, that care factor and looking beyond our lifestyle superpower and Cottesloe Beach and out to the broader horizons. So thanks for giving that really systematic, engaging and really detailed analysis on a balance sheet really of our soft power, both negative and positive. And I think tonight will really make us think about our influence and our position going forward in the future to keep in the centre and to keep well liked. Because I think, as you're right, it would be a shock to go overseas, and even for lots of us who travel overseas, and we're always so welcomed. And it would be a real shame for some of those issues that you mentioned before to change that for all of us, not even just for our politicians, but just for us as general citizens and travellers of the world and international citizens. So thank you very much, Ben, for your presentation this evening.